Welcome to the C-Suite podcast that we're recording at South by Southwest in Austin, Texas. I'm Russell Goldsmith, and together with Graham Barrett, we'll be chatting to a number of the speakers and attendees here at the conference.
We're producing the show in partnership with Remote, the global HR platform, and we'll be recording the conversations in their booth here in the Creative Industries Expo. This particular episode features interviews with Larry Miller, chairman of the Jordan Brand Advisory Board at Nike, Ken Oliver, VP of Corporate Social Responsibility at Checker, and Jeffrey Korzenick, chief economist at Fifth Third Bank, who all spoke on a panel about the efforts being made to remove the barriers to employment for the millions of Americans with an arrest or conviction record. Some truly amazing stories coming up. Okay, I'm here with Jeffrey Korzenick. He is the chief economist at Fifth Third Bank. Jeffrey, lovely to see you here today.
Nice to be with you.
Your first South by Southwest, I hear.
I'm welcome. Absolutely. So.
Now, you're speaking on a session, aren't you, about, this is a fascinating subject, a creative way to address the growing labor shortage. What can you tell us about the session? It's called Building a Fairer Future of Work, One Job at a Time.
Sure. So first of all, I have to preface this by saying, although I am the chief economist for Fifth Third Bank, the work I do in this area is distinct and separate from the bank. So I'm here representing myself, and Fifth Third Bank has been enormously supportive of my research, but this is my own gig. And I'm very pleased to be part of this session. It's got some great luminaries in this field. We've got Ken Oliver with Checker, who's been a big proponent of taking his lived experience in the prison system and recognizing the value of people who are behind bars, people who aren't behind bars but have convictions, and telling the business community, particularly in his case, the high-tech community, this is a solution to your labor shortage. There's a lot of talent here. Larry Miller, his personal story, also growing up gang life, he became the head of the Jordan brand for Nike. He's was president of the Portland Trailblazers team, and he's there representing that story and as well. And then Genevieve Martin, who's with The Last Mile, which is offers tech training and a pipeline in the tech industry for people in prison. It's an incredible team to be with.
Yeah, so that sounds like an awesome session. So give me the background to it then. Why are you such an advocate of fair chance hiring?
Sure. So I've been in the business community and as an economist, 35 plus years of experience. And one of the things that you have to learn as an economist is what drives growth is really boils down to how fast can you grow your workforce and how productive can they be. So it's really a human capital discussion. Yeah. And we have a problem in the United States, quite severely, but also throughout the developed world, we stopped having enough babies 25 and 30 years ago.
Yeah.
So our older generations are retiring out of the workforce, but they're still consumers. And we no longer have the steady inflow of new workers to meet their demands.
Wow.
That's a labor shortage. It's holding back growth. It's creating inflation. We have to look for talent where we've never looked before.
Yeah.
And it's not the only solution, but in this country, the 19 million Americans with felony convictions, the tens of millions more with misdemeanors, are the single largest and most overlooked talent pool in the United States. So it's a solution to a big economic problem.
Yeah, no, that's great. It's just, you've analyzed the data. It's just really a solution, as you say. Tell me about some of the barriers then. I mean, why wouldn't you do this if you're a company? What are some of the barriers that prevent companies from taking on these people?
So there tend to be three objections. One revolves around liability. We're a very litigious society in the United States. Liability and risk, safety issues. Second objection is quality. Can this population really do good work? And number three, there's concerns over reputation. I think that's kind of an old-fashioned thing. Most consumers, most employees want to work for or do business with an enterprise that is adding value to society, not just dropping money to the bottom line and to shareholders.
Yeah. And maybe what are some of the benefits of bringing on these people?
Well, the benefit, and I have to emphasize, you only get the benefits if you do it right. So there are lots of businesses, when I first started talking about this around the country, would come up to me and say, oh no, that wasn't my experience. I had a bad experience.
Yeah.
Well, like anything else, you have to do it the right way. And the benefits, if you do it the right way, are not just that you get another employee, but people with records who are eager to prove to the world that they are more than their worst mistakes tend to be exceptionally loyal and engaged employees. And that's a recipe for productivity and profitability.
Okay. So what advice do you have then for some of these companies? What is the best way to set yourself up so you can take on people with conviction records?
So you can't just flip a switch. You have to understand our whole environment and how this happened and where people with records are coming from in their life journey. Yeah. A lot of people who have records got to that place because they have poor histories in their of family employment and mentorship. So you have to understand their gaps in this population. But ultimately, you have to understand how do you select from this group and what supports do they need to thrive? That's like any talent process. Find who's a good fit. Give them the tools to thrive. It's just with this population, how you pick them, how you support them is a little different. The best thing to do is start with proof of concept. Mm-hmm. Go visit companies that are already doing this. Go participate in any of these cohort-based training programs. I've supported one in Chicago that helped teach businesses how to do this the right way. It's an education process, has to be the start.
Okay, and how confident are you that the solutions that you're proposing can be implemented across corporate America?
Oh, 100%, because I've seen it work. And all of my research, I've been looking at this for over a decade now. As you know, I'm the author of a book called Untapped Talent, which brings a lot of that into a single place for business owners. I have seen it work across industries, in different geographies. It always works if you do it right. It's just so many businesses don't know how to do it right, or have made assumptions about this talent pool that have led them to avoid this group. We're in a labor shortage. It's a structural labor shortage. You can't overlook anyone.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be a fascinating session. I hope it goes well with Ken and with Larry and Jeffrey Kozenik. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much.
Okay, I'm here with Larry Miller, who is the chairman of the Jordan Brand Advisory Board at Nike.
Correct.
Lovely to see you here. How you doing?
Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, no, it's awesome that you spent the time to come over here. So thanks so much. Now, you're here at South by Southwest to talk about second fair chance hiring, aren't you? So, and that's all to do with bringing those with an arrest or conviction record into the workforce.
Right.
Now, that's something that's very personal to you, isn't it?
It is.
Listen, I know this is difficult, but if you could tell me about, you know, what happened back in September 1965 for our listeners, I'd be grateful.
Well, so from the age of about 12 to 30, I was in and out of jail. I was in a gang, involved in a bunch of criminal activity. And when I was 16 years old, I shot another kid and he died. I was sentenced. I was tried as an adult, pled guilty to second degree murder, was sentenced to 4.5 to 20 years. Did the 4.5, got out, was still caught up in the recidivism of the criminal justice system and kind of the revolving door. Ended up back in jail with had 5 armed robbery charges. And when I was arrested that time, I decided I wanted to change my life and that I was tired of the criminal life. And they had an opportunity. And when the last time I was arrested, the jail I was in had a program where you could take college classes inside the jail.
Okay.
And then you could qualify to move into these trailers that were actually outside the jail. You lived in those trailers.
Okay.
And were able to leave every day and go to school and have to be back by the evening. So I got into that program. I got my associate's degree while I was in that program, and then transferred to a halfway house in North Philadelphia, transferred my credits to Temple University and got my bachelor's degree from Temple.
Wow.
And started my career. But the challenge was getting past my background, getting past the things that I had gotten involved in as in the criminal activity.
Yeah. So do you think that's a secret? When you do spend that time in prison, you've got to be thinking about the next thing and when you're coming out. Is that how you get through it mentally?
I think absolutely that's a big part of getting through it mentally. And the question is, what are you planning to do when you get out? And for me, the last time was, that's when I was decided that I wanted to change my life and try to do something constructive and positive in my life.
But I guess at that point, you didn't know how far you could go. And obviously you've written this amazing book, which tells about your story, you know, from that background to the upper echelons of the corporate world, as it were. How did you do it? How did you turn it around?
Well, you know, like I said, I decided to get my education. And to me, education was the game changer for me. That was the thing that really made the major difference for me, was getting an education. And having that opportunity to do that, starting while I was incarcerated and then completing it afterwards, it really made me believe that I could do something different with my life.
Yeah.
When I was about to graduate from Temple with a degree in accounting, it was what was called the Big Eight accounting firms at the point. And I was looking to connect with one of them, and the one I was focused on was called Arthur Anderson. And so I ended up spending the whole day there interviewing with a number of people, and all day in the back of my mind, I'm like, should I share my background? Because all they knew is I was a young black man about to graduate with honors from Temple University with an accounting degree. So I get through the whole day, and finally I get to the end, and the last guy is the hiring manager. So I decide I'm going to share my story with him. And so I kind of start telling him my story. And as I'm talking to him, I can see his face changing, but not in a good way.
Yeah, yeah.
And finally I get done, and he said, wow, that's an amazing story. I'm glad you're going to do great. And he reached in his pocket and pulled out an envelope. He said, I had an offer letter here that I was all ready to give you, but I can't give it to you now. He said, I can't take the chance on giving you a job. I wish you the best, but I can't hire you. And at that point, I decided I wasn't going to share that information. I wasn't going to deny it if it came up or lie about it, but I wasn't going to volunteer the information.
It's almost like you had two turning points in your life, didn't you? You had that time when you were going to go into jail for the second time, when you decided, look, this isn't me anymore. I want to turn this around. And that was almost like a second turning point, wasn't it, to keep you silent?
It really was. And so for 40 years, I built my career with people that I worked with closely every day, and people that that are friends and I consider family, who had no clue about my background, because I just did not share it with anyone, because I knew if I did, or I believed that if I did, it would hinder what I was trying to accomplish.
Yeah. But how much does that eat away at you, having to keep that secret, not even having one confidant that you can relay this this story to?
It really worked on me. I had recurring nightmares of going back to jail. I had migraines so bad that I ended up in the ER a few times. So it was really eating at me. And so being able to share the story and kind of put it out there has been like a real relief for me.
It's
been very freeing for me.
Yeah. Well, I guess, we're talking about turning points. Then that's the third and final one, isn't it? If this is three acts,
exactly.
I guess. So why did you decide to... your story is called Jump, My Secret Journey, isn't it? The book's out now. It came out 2 years ago. What was the motivation behind writing?
My oldest daughter, for many, many, many years, worked on me and said, Dad, you know, you should share your story. It can motivate and inspire people. And I pushed her off for years. But finally, she convinced me that it was something that I would do, and that we would work on it together. And so her and I actually worked on the book together. But it was really her pushing and prodding me that really made me understand and believe that it could have a major impact. And so far, she was right. It is having an impact on people, on the way people view formerly incarcerated people, on providing hope for people who are incarcerated or who were formerly incarcerated, and understand that they still have the opportunity to change their life and move their life in a positive direction. So I'm glad that she convinced me to do it. And it's been freeing for me. The other major part of it for me is that I was able to connect with the family of the young man that I shot and killed, and met with them, sat down, and kind of expressed my sorrow and remorse to them.
Yep.
And it was his sister, his son, and his daughter. And each one of them talked about how it affected them. But they also, at the end of each one of them speaking, they said, but I forgive you.
Wow.
And you know, I was 16, I was drunk out of my mind, I was mad with the gang stuff, and it just was, and he was an innocent person. It was just, he happened to be at the wrong place at the wrong time, and it's something that I regret every day of my life.
I'm sure.
And I was able to express that to them, and they forgave me, which is the best thing that I could have asked for.
I mean, I was going to say, obviously, you know, the book is awesome and you want to get great feedback from that. And if you can help others in your position, then that's great. But to have that forgiveness, that must be the most important thing.
That was the most important thing for me. And coming out of this whole process, that's the thing that means the most to me, is the fact that that I was able to get that forgiveness from the family.
And you mentioned Layla, your daughter, who helped you with the book. When did you first tell her, and how difficult a moment was that?
So once I agreed to do this with her, our process was, her and I would get together And we would, she'd ask questions, I'd tell stories, and we would record it, and then she'd go back and transcribe it. And it was in one of those sessions that I was like, okay, I'm gonna tell you this. And she knew I had been to jail, because I mean, she was used to come visit me when she was a child, but she didn't know any of the details. And it was pretty tough to share it with her. But once I got it out with her, it's been much, much easier. And the nightmare stopped. Once I started talking to her, the nightmare stopped, the migraine stopped, and you know, it really lifted a burden off of me being able to share that story with her.
Yeah, it's amazing. Now, then, if we go back to your, you know, the corporate world and your career, you didn't just do well, you know, you did it exceedingly well, didn't you? You really flew out of the traps, as it were, and you became president, didn't you, of the Jordan brand. I know you're on the chairman of the advisory board now, but you were president of the Jordan brand. I guess you had to tell people like Michael Jordan and Phil Knight about your past. Well, how was that?
Actually, I didn't.
Okay.
They didn't find out until I was ready. We were about to do the book. Once I knew I was definitely going to do the book, and there was a list of people that I wanted to make sure that they heard it from me before they heard it somewhere else.
Yeah.
And those two were at the top of the list, Phil Knight and Michael Jordan. And it was really pretty amazing. It was during the pandemic, so I couldn't get together with them face to face. So I had to do it virtually with both. And
so was it over the telephone or a Teams call or a Zoom call?
FaceTime call.
Right. Yeah.
And it was really, really amazing. I mean, I kind of went through the whole story of my daughter. This is with both of them individually, but not, you know.
Yeah.
And each one of them, after I was done, said, MJ, I can hear his voice saying, I agree with your daughter. You should share the story.
Right.
And if whatever I can do to help, let me know. And they both said that and have been extremely helpful and supportive during this whole process.
And again, that must mean the world to you, you know, those people that you've worked with so long that I'm sure you hugely respect, to get their backing as well must be big.
That was big for me. Once I kind of shared with the two of them and they were encouraging and positive, I really said I must be doing the right thing. And I think if either one of them had been reluctant, I probably still would have done it, but I would have been a little more reluctant. But having the encouragement and the support from the two of them, that really made a major difference for
me. Now listen, at the top of this interview, we talked about this session that you're going to be on in terms of, you know, second chance, fair chance hiring. What have your experiences taught you about how we should approach this and, you know, just the recruitment process in general, I guess, big companies like Nike or smaller ones?
Well, I absolutely believe that there is an untapped resource in terms of people who have been or are currently incarcerated. I think, you know, the reality is, so one of the things I'm really happy and proud about is that Harvard Business School decided to do a case study based on my book and my story.
Yeah.
And one of the things that they built a lot of context around it, but one of the charts that they showed in there is the recidivism rate, people within 2 years ending up back in prison here in the U.S. is about 77%.
Right.
But when people are able to learn a skill or a trade, 77% drops to 30%.
Wow, that's huge.
Someone gets a bachelor's degree, where people get a 77% drops to 6%, and a master's degree is at zero. So to me, that's clear-cut indication that education or people being able to learn a marketable skill set really changes their lives, and that people will absolutely become contributors to their community if given the opportunity. And so I think you know, that's why one of the things I've been talking a lot about is giving folks these opportunities. Some of the smartest, most creative people I've ever met are people I met when I was incarcerated.
Yeah.
To me, how do we tap into that creativity, that intellect, and really, you know, start to give folks an opportunity to show what they can do?
Yeah.
And again, I think companies who realize that and who really kind of tap into that resource are going to be winners.
Yeah.
There was I was at a conference not too long ago, and there was a woman there who had formerly been incarcerated, and her boss was there, the guy who she worked for now, and he was singing her praises and saying what a great worker she was. And someone asked her about the opportunity. What did she think about the opportunity she'd been given? And she said, you know, I don't see this as an opportunity. I see it as a privilege. And when you have people who feel like that about their job, that it's a privilege for them to do it, those are people you're going to get the most out of. And so to me, I think there's this incredible opportunity. I got up every day and still get up every day feeling like it's a privilege for me to be able to do what I do. Because, you know, by right and the things that I've been through, you know, it's challenging. People couldn't see me in doing what I've done. So I look at it as a privilege. And I think if you hire people who feel that way about their job and their career, you're going to get the best workers you can possibly get.
Yeah, sure. Is there something about adversity as well? People who've been through those situations, they've had to overcome the challenge of a time in prison. Is there something about that that really kind of makes them that solid worker?
Yeah, you know, I say this some, but I'd be sitting in a meeting and people are concerned about the fact that I don't know, a shoe didn't sell or something, and I'm sitting there and I'm like, you know what? Nobody's got a gun to my head. I'm not in front of a judge trying to. We can figure this out.
Gives you perspective.
Yeah, we can figure this out.
You know what I mean? And
so it does give you perspective.
Yeah. Well, what's next? Just tell us what. Obviously, as I said, you're still chairman of the Jordan Advisory Board, so you're still very busy with that. But I guess you want to do more of this work in terms of inspiring others and helping others who have been on a similar path to you?
Absolutely. Since my book has come out and since I've kind of told my story, I have met so many people that are doing this work, that are really involved in trying to make some positive changes to the criminal justice system. And I want to help that however I can. And that's been a big part of what I've been doing and what I plan to continue to do is like, how can I lend my story, lend my support to efforts to make positive changes in the criminal justice system?
Yeah. Listen, you're going to be a huge part of that story. You know, you're inspiring to all the people you come in contact with, I'm sure. Yours is an incredible story. Larry Miller, really appreciate you taking the time today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
I'm here with Ken Oliver, who is the VP of Corporate Social Responsibility at Checker. Ken, it's lovely to see you here today.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no, we're really excited to have you on the podcast. You're speaking on a session here at South by Southwest called Building a Fairer Future of Work. It's all about providing pathways to employment for, the 80 million Americans who suffer from an arrest and conviction record.
That's
right. Fascinating stuff. Tell us a little bit more about it.
Sure. Well, a lot of people don't know, and I'm glad that you just educated them. 80 million people in America have an arrest record. That's about one third of the workforce. And so in America, that's a scarlet letter because 95% of companies run background checks. And so when people run up against a background check when they're trying to apply for employment or housing or to get into a university, et cetera, typically the scarlet letter of an arrest record will exclude someone from consideration.
Sure.
So we're on a mission at Checker. We're the biggest background check company in America. We're on a mission at Checker to use background checks as tools of inclusivity and understanding the human story behind the piece of paper that is a background check. And so we're trying to get people into economic mobility and get them into livable wage jobs.
Yeah, yeah. Now you come at this topic from a position of authority due to your own lived experience, don't you? Could you share that experience, please?
Sure. Well, I don't advise anybody to get on my career path. No. How I landed here as a VP, but I did 24 years myself in a California prison, almost. I did 9 of those in solitary confinement for reading a book. And so when I was released in 2019, I saw what it was like for people in the job market and saw how difficult it was for people to rebuild their lives. So I sat off on purpose to go out and kick in doors for other people and to educate America and build a new bottom of a bell curve on what it means to have a record and what it doesn't mean and show the potential that we have in the value proposition.
Yeah. Tell me about, in terms of your experience inside, I mean, it's such a long time, especially all those years in solitary as well. Just confirm, I mean, why were you in jail in the first place?
Sure.
Because, it's one of those 3 strikes and you're in kind of rules, wasn't it? Would that be
right.
fair to say?
No, for sure.
Yeah.
I was given life in prison for being a passenger in a stolen vehicle, believe it or not.
Really?
And usually that carries a weekend in jail, a slap on the wrist, but because of things I'd gotten into during my youth, I fell under the 3 strikes law where in California they were striking people out and giving them life sentences for stealing a pack of cigarettes.
Yeah.
And so I got life in prison and did 24 years and, came out still standing, luckily, but it wasn't easy.
I've met you before this interview today. You're a very positive person. You've got lots of energy. How do you manage to be positive in light of all those experiences? How are you not bitter, angry, etc.?
Sure. Well, one of the ways that I do it is recognizing that I'm extremely privileged and blessed. I'm extremely humbled to even have gotten out of prison when I was given a life sentence. And then the amazing community of people that have embraced me and provided me pathways and opportunities have allowed me to be the best version of myself. And so I wouldn't be able to sleep at night if I knew that so many people had helped me and been responsible for my own career trajectory if I didn't reach back and give that opportunity to others. And so I really live my life in service of people who have gone through similar things that I've gone through, Larry and other people you talked to yesterday. And I don't think I have time or energy to be depressed or angry or bitter. I'm just trying to stay optimistic and move forward to the future and make a better future for everybody.
Yeah, well, that is inspiring. It truly is. Tell me a little bit about your journey then to Checker. I said you are VP of Corporate Social Responsibility. Sure. So, how did that, when you came out of jail, how did you get up the ladder?
It's kind of an interesting trajectory. I got out and I became a paralegal at a public interest law firm about 2 weeks out. And then about 2 months later, my executive director came to me, said, Ken, we knew that you could write legal briefs. You wrote your way out of prison, but we didn't know that you could talk.
Right.
And so we're gonna make you a public policy director. And they sent me to the Capitol to go talk to legislators and the governor's office about criminal justice reform in general. That's kind of where I cut my teeth. And then about a year later, an opportunity came to me to become an executive director of a startup nonprofit. And so I took that opportunity and built out a workforce business plan and started working with the legislature and the governor's office. And in 2021, they gave me $28.5 million to build out the first ever residentially based tech training program for justice impacted men and women. And then shortly thereafter, Checker, who had kind of been doing fair chance hiring since 2015, they wanted to tap somebody with lived experience to come in and build out their corporate social responsibility division and build a corporate foundation. And I was fortunate enough and blessed enough that they chose me.
Now, you spoke earlier about some of the barriers that people with conviction records face when trying to get into the job market. What are some of the positive benefits of employing people like yourself with these kind of backgrounds?
Sure. So, you know, I talked a little bit earlier about the Scarlet Letter. And what happens is we've all told ourselves a narrative about what a arrest or conviction history means. And the reality is most of that narrative is false. And so the people that have been arrested or convicted are our brothers. They're our uncles. They're our fathers. They're our sisters. They're our mothers. And they all have a tremendous amount of potential to contribute to society and be a tax asset rather than a tax burden. And so when people hire justice impacted people and give them an opportunity, usually what we see in the data shows that they're the most loyal because they haven't been given opportunities before. They promote faster and at a more multiple clip than average employees, right? Because they have something to prove. They're great culture carriers for organizations because they've shown that they've gone from tragedy to triumph and they're able to thrive.
Adversity
and exhibiting that resilience to be able to go. I know people who grew up in the projects who are now software engineers at our company, right? And have just overcome amazing odds. And so it's a great inspiration for company employees and people who are privileged, right? In many cases, who see people come from the ashes and rise up to add tremendous amount of value to a company like Checker and others.
So now what you do, isn't it, you go out to corporates and try to encourage them to go down this route. What are some of the feedback you get there? Is it positive? Are people happy to help?
Sure. Well, there's a big movement in the United States for companies to source talent in different ways because there's a labor shortage. And so when you look at the future of work and we recognize that there's 10 million job openings and only 5 million people available to fill them, we have to now start sourcing talent in different ways. And because there are so many people who have records in this country, what we do is we go in and talk to corporate America about here's a talent pool that's previously untapped. Here's a talent pool where you can find really true gems, people that can excel all up and down the career ladders, whether it's business development, whether it's sales, whether it's marketing, whether it's policy. We have people that can thrive in all of those areas. They just need to be given an opportunity.
Okay, brilliant. What's next? If you could just finish up with this, you're making great strides, but I don't feel we're completely there yet. Would that be fair? What else needs to be done?
Well, what's next for us at Checker.org is we're going to take over the world. aside from taking over the world, what we plan to do is just continue to change the narrative. What we have to do is unwind something that goes all the way back to King's England, which is this notion of civil death. Right, this notion that if you break the law, you'll no longer be able to participate in civil society. And that's kind of carried over the last 1,000 years in America. There's 44,000 collateral consequences, legal barriers that attach once a person gets out of prison or has been convicted of a crime. So we have to continue over the next probably a few decades to continue to change the narrative of what it means for somebody who's made a mistake in their life. People are more valuable than the worst mistake they've ever made. Yeah. So we'll continue along that track, and we'll also continue to work with companies and teach change management. We'll continue to teach them how to hire and onboard justice-impacted people, and we'll continue to create training programs like apprenticeship programs for people to give them opportunity to thrive if that's what they want to do.
That's awesome. If you could give one piece of advice to someone who is maybe just going into prison now, or maybe just coming out, what would that one piece of advice be?
Stay hustling, stay grinding, stay reading, stay educating yourself, because there are thousands of people out here that are convincing people to open doors for you. Yeah. So be ready to meet the moment when the opportunity comes.
Yeah. That is inspiring stuff. We really enjoyed having you on the podcast and hearing the story. We wish you all the best with, furthering this, because as you say, there is a shortage in the job market. That's so right. This is important what you're doing. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate you.
Not at all.
Thanks so much again to all our guests who took the time to chat with us on Remote's booth here at South by Southwest.
Really hope you've enjoyed this episode. Please do follow us wherever you get your podcasts, and please do give us a positive rating and review. Plus, you can find us on all the usual social channels.
And if you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can do that via the contact form on the website at csuitepodcast.com. But for now, from me, Russell Goldsmith, and Graham Barrett, thanks very much for listening, and goodbye.